Welcome to Strategy Talk, where the editors and contributors of Strategy Village discuss current events and other military-related topics with a splash of history. I'm your host, Dan Masterson. Joining us today is Jim Dunnigan, editor of Strategy Page, well-known military author, and acknowledged pioneer and innovator in board war games. Also joining us today is Austin Bay, associate editor of Strategy Page, military author, columnist, and retired Colonel, U.S. Army Reserves. Welcome, Austin and Jim. Austin, you brought up an interesting topic, which is about what are the lessons learned that Taiwan can take from the Ukraine incident. I know that Ukraine has caused Russia and China to become closer allies. And in fact, there was a conversation with Putin and Xi last week or the week before, I can't remember which, where, you know, Putin basically said, hey, we're buddies and we've got to stay buddies because of the hegemon of the United States. So can you explain what Taiwan can learn from Ukraine?
Well, Dan, let me make a quick comment on Vlad and Xi buddying up like that. Don't believe anything they say. You know, that's the general advice I'd say about both of those dictators. Yeah, they need each other in certain areas. They hope the other one will cooperate, and Russia's in a particular bind now. But I have a lot of doubts about their commitment to one another, despite having some of the naval exercises they're having in the Pacific with Russian and Chinese, mainland Chinese ships sailing around and conducting attacks on supposed American submarines, things like that. Well, look, from the beginning, I'm going to say not the beginning, because the beginning is in February 2014 of the war, but the conventional phase that began in February of 2022, I thought, here they go. Here come the Russians. It's going to be this overwhelming attack, or at least that's what they're going to try to do. And by the way, Jim and I did a strategy talk. I want to say it was in the end of January, early February, where we talked about whether they were going to attack or not. And Jim thought odds weren't there. I said, you got to pay attention to what the map says, but we could see the buildup and see it on satellite. So there's that component right there, Dan, to start off with. What can Taiwan learn? Pay attention to the map. Pay attention to the intel you're getting. And of course, Ukraine got absolutely superior intelligence on where the Russians were putting their troops, where they're going to make their moves. And like, same thing applies to Taiwan. You got to be able to look across the strait, know what's going on in Fujian province, which is across the strait, but also the Chinese naval deployments, Chinese aircraft, figure out what they're loading on their, what the ordnance, the aircraft are being loaded on the aircraft. Where are the short range and medium range ballistic missiles and cruise missiles? So there's the battlefield preparation phase, which if I step back and listen to what I just said, of course, that's what professionals are supposed to do all the time. When you're considering when you're on the defense, whether you're on the offense, which you got to know as much as you can about the enemy's deployments. And then what do you know about intent? Well, another guide on Taiwan is Vlad Putin had been intent on taking Ukraine, and it even started it in 2014. So believe them when they say they're going to do it. Taiwan, believe Xi Jinping when he says he intends to retake the island. But those are the those are the general strategic indicators. One of the reasons I brought it up, Dan, as a potential topic is I remember from March on, various articles and essays I read, even some things I wrote, saying that, you know, what are we seeing here about a certain type of 21st century conventional warfare? And that's, are they lessons learned, or is this is the learning experience? That's a, I think, a better frame for it, is because the Ukrainians have been learning very quickly and adapting very, very quickly. And we saw also the destructiveness of advanced infantry, man-packed weapons. I mean, I was pulling my reserve duty in the Assistant Secretary of the Army's for Research, Development, and Acquisition office for about 4 years, like 1990 to 94, maybe it's five years. And I did two things, anywhere from 2 weeks to 3 weeks a year, work on heavy wheeled vehicles, new family, and the other one was missiles. And here I am. Do I have a background in missiles? No, but I got a background in missiles, including trips down to Huntsville to see some of the missiles under development, and of course full briefings on capabilities of current missiles in development. I mean, current missiles, but also missiles in development. So I knew a lot about Javelin, and it was an amazing weapon. Its origins are still in the Cold War. What are we going to do if the Russians come through the fold gap? But you've got a weapon system here that it gives an infantry unit real reach, 1,500, 2,000 meters in a top-down attack. So I'm quite impressed with that. Also, I'm impressed with the Stinger, but the advanced Stinger that we have now. And you saw what those two systems used by competent soldiers can do to a mechanized army. I understand that the Ukraine also was fielding mechanized forces, so the head-to-head with those Russian tank and mechanized infantry columns, but also the small packets with distributed infantry packets armed with these kinds of weapons and also supported with drones. Now, some of this was evident, Dan, in March and April. There were comments on it. You can go back and look at things on strategy page that Jim and some of the other material that you published, Dan, since you're the webmaster. But these tidbits were out there. It's part of the learning process. Now, I'm going to say the first article I read online in the defense press about lessons learned, or what is Ukraine telling us, and then connecting it to other potential battlefields, Taiwan being the premier one. They were already being written. And I don't mean to be harsh about it. Again, it's drips and drabs, and you're watching something in a process. But I think there were two that impressed me out of it. And they were, as I recall, both of them were done by retired officers, I think the Army and Marine. But wait a minute, there was another one too by a naval officer looking at Taiwan and trying to sift through it, because you know there are geographical differences that to be considered. So you had three, and this is, I'm doing this from memory, Dan, but you know, three individuals with professional credentials who would not just see it based on Reuters news reports, and I'm not running down Reuters or Daily Mail, even the British tabloids done some great reporting out of Ukraine, but trying to sift through it and say, how would we use what we've learned or what we've seen and apply it to a on the ground, in the air, under the sea situation with either American forces or American allied forces. So there were, you know, some very thoughtful, I'm now saying three thoughtful pieces that I saw. So I also thought this would be a topic for Jim and me to address on a strategy talk, even though you go back, I think, a half dozen times this year, we've already talked about what's going on the ground. And I'll point to another one, Jim's discussion of Winter War, which was a couple of months ago when we first touched on it, because we're seeing one now under, again, peculiar conditions, but at the same time watching effects that soldiers in World War I or in 300 AD would understand with the cold and the snow and the slush and the mud. I'll make a big difference is Taiwan has a geographic advantage that Ukraine doesn't, and that's the Taiwan Strait. It's also a big rock. I've been there, what, twice. I mean, got to see one of their, from a distance, but it was one of their airfields cut out of the bottom of a mountain. They're very similar to what the Swiss do with their Alpine airfields, except it was looked to me like a squadron of F-16s in there. And they would roll out, and there was a strip, but also they could take off from the highway that I happened to be on that passed it. So it requires an amphibious or airborne operation for ground troops. And that says a lot about what kind of weapons Taiwan needs. The other difference, main difference, and that's a huge one, though, is that Ukraine had a little preparatory war to train soldiers in on-the-job training, and that's the war in the Donbas that begins really in April of 2014. They also had time for, and I come back, and this is a reading for British and American special operations troops and intelligence officers to provide training, aid, and thankfully the Trump administration starts sending them javelins. I think that decision was made in late 2017 or early 2018 to give them a very capable anti-armor system that they could use. Translate into Taiwan. Taiwan's got to analyze what are the key modern weapon systems we need to acquire. I think they already have a good idea of it. I'll leave that to Jim to comment on. It's just there are all these restrictions about what you can sell or provide Taiwan. It's part of kowtowing to the Chinese Communist Party. That's gonna have to end. And I think the other model, and I'm sure this will come up again, is that Ukraine has given us another example of what a nation in arms that really wants to defend itself, morale does, and the kind of problems they present an invader. And it's Finland, and it's Israel. Israel doesn't have any geographic advantages, but it's got technological and it's got morale advantages and training advantages. And that's how they keep their nation in arms safe. And the Finns fight the same way, but they've got their front with Russia is one I really wouldn't want to try to test with conventional forces. Anyway, that's Switzerland is a nation in arms, too. And South Korea is. And South Korea's got Switzerland doesn't have any existential threat. South Korea does, but it's got right up there in the border. There's some tough terrain. And plus, they're organized. They have got modern weapons. And the rocks are rocks. Republic of Korea, they're soldiers. They train tough soldiers. But their nation in arms prepared to resist not just North Korea, but China as well. And I think that's another major point. Anyway, that may be a long introduction, but I think it does bring us up to the point of saying, are there things we can take and apply to other situations and likely combat zones? And I think there are, and Taiwan, I think, is the most pertinent.
Jim, your thoughts on this?
Well, Taiwan has really gotten into gear in terms of militarizing. Now, they've actually been doing this for over 10 years, but now they've really accelerated. For example, recently, they extended the period of mandatory service from 4 months to a year. Now, until 2017, it was a year. But they thought they could go to an all-volunteer army, and that didn't really work out, and they need more troops. Right now, they have about 180,000 active-duty troops. 90% of them are volunteers. Now, they believe that they will be at maximum, defensive situation in about 5 years. The one-year military obligation doesn't start until 2024. They are making purchases. We agreed to sell them, $10 billion worth of military weapons without hardly any restrictions. They've also been building a lot of their own weapons when they couldn't get them from us. They are preparing to deal with an amphibious as well as a airborne operation, in addition to a heavy attack by the Chinese ballistic missiles. Now, we saw what the advantages and the shortcomings were of these, the short-range conventional ballistic missiles were in Ukraine. They're not super weapons. And once the Ukrainians got, somewhat modern anti-aircraft weapons, they could intercept a lot of them. And this is what the Taiwanese are doing. They are learning from Taiwan. But yes, one of the things they noticed more than anything else was that the Ukrainians had 7 years to diligently prepare, between 2014 and 2022. And they spent that time pretty well. I mean, a lot of Ukrainians weren't eager to, join the military, until there was an actual, invasion, which nobody really expected. Because they considered it, somewhat insane. But then they realized that Putin was up to the challenge. They, as Austin pointed out, they started getting American weapons in 2017, 2018. But they were getting tests, as it were, of these weapons even before that. NATO, including the United States, was sending in military advisors. And basically, during that 7 years, the Ukrainians learned how to fight like Western forces, not like Russian forces. Remember, in 2014, their military, their doctrine, their organization was pretty much a carbon copy of what the Russians had. In that 7 years, they changed. Now, Taiwan has always had a Western orientation to their military operations, but they thought that they had other advantages over China. For example, technology. A lot of the key electronics manufacturing done in China are really subsidiaries of Taiwanese firms. Well, the Taiwanese are cutting that off. Now, they say they're not doing it permanently, but they're apparently doing it as a way to slow down China's effort to free themselves from dependence on Taiwanese tech, because the problem in the past has always been if the Chinese attacked Taiwan, Taiwan defended, there was a lot of fighting, a lot of things going boom in Taiwan, they would basically, if they won, they would get a smoking, wreckage. All that technology would be gone, I expect, you know, in the run-up to the war, or even during the war, a lot of Taiwanese would get out. So they would basically have a hollow shell, as it were. They're not as afraid of that. But the big problem is they have noted the Taiwanese preparations and how they're accelerating. So they feel sort of under the gun. If they don't do it now, it's only going to be a lot more difficult in 5 years. So, you know, Austin's analysis is correct. There is a, how should I put it, an urge to attack sooner rather than later. The question is, can they do it? You got to remember, China is having some serious internal problems. That COVID lockdown, which was overthrown literally by the A4, you know, revolution. A4 is their standard 8.5 by 11, you know, paper. And for the first time, the Chinese people cracked the Great Firewall of China. You know, their huge bureaucracy that restricts what can be said on the internet and how many and makes it more difficult for people to communicate outside of China. By the time the Chinese government said, all right, you know, we're gonna cut the, you know, the shutdowns, et cetera, and they were able to basically reimpose their control, the lesson had already been learned. If the people get angry enough, China cannot suppress them. Now, the Chinese also have a problem with their military. They are in the midst of the after effects of the one-child policy, which went on for about 30 years, 1980s until, you know, let's say the last 5-10 years. They basically released all the restrictions on how many children a family can have. But at this point, a lot of families say, well, why have more kids? You know, the economy is not doing that well. It's getting worse, and the babies are not being born. And the ratio of working age Chinese to, you know, older and, you know, below working age Chinese is getting increasingly unfavorable to China. Now, at the moment, when they cut back on the COVID restrictions, they're having a lot more cases. Now, this is the milder form COVID has mutated into, which is fairly typical of these, how should I put it, harsh, influenza type diseases. They will basically mutate into, you know, less lethal, damaging forms. And that's what happened to the Spanish flu in 1918. Chinese, however, have all these problems coming on top of them all at once. They have this banking crisis, you know, with these all these bad loans, all these ghost cities. I mean, literally, you know, hundreds of high-rise buildings and no residents because they overbuilt and nobody was checking their, you know, marketing data. Actually, that it was worse than that. It was local provincial authorities, which still have a lot of authority, and they were basically getting loans from state-run banks who were under orders to, you know, if they could make a halfway decent case, give them the money. And a lot of the provinces were doing it at the same time, and the central government didn't really catch on to how bad this was until it was too late. You had hundreds of billions in bad loans. You know, their government debt, you know, ratio was much worse than ours, even adjusting for population and what have you. And the Chinese still haven't, you know, come up with a solution for that. And we report on this in Strategy Page regularly. They have come up with fairly some solutions, but a lot of them involve Chinese, investors, as it were, taking the biggest haircut. In other words, losing the most. And they even basically, they didn't want to hit the foreign investors, who are a small percentage of the investors in these real estate efforts, because they didn't want to ruin their international credit rating. But it got so bad where they even had to give themselves a lower international credit rating because they couldn't even sustain leaving the foreign investors alone. So they have a problem there. And of course, the economy is slowing down. It's, in fact, it looks like for this year, the way things are going, and they keep getting worse and worse, it's going to be less than 1%. It might even be negative. Another problem the Chinese had, which they, I don't think they fully, addressed, was for years, local officials were feeding false data to the central government. In other words, the central government didn't go around collecting, data on who was spending what and who had how much debt and what have you. They would leave it up to provincial officials to send it. And about 5 or 6 years ago, again, we reported this in Strategy Page, it started to come out that one province after another was admitting that, we might have cooked the numbers a little bit. So that 30 years of 10% a year growth had to be downrated, as it were. It was high. It was higher than any country in the West, but it certainly wasn't 10%. They're still the second largest economy in the world, but not the second strongest economy by any means. Second strongest large economy. They have a lot of weaknesses, and they have to work those out. Going to war over Taiwan is risky from an economic basis, because that might mean, the United States and now Japan. Japan recently signed on, as it were, says we will fully participate in defending Taiwan. South Korea is waffling back and forth because they're closer to China. They're not an island. But even they have become more aggressive against, the North Korean shenanigans and what have you. So the tides are not moving in China's favor. And again, it puts their leaders in a very bad position, because Russia has turned out to be a lot more of a liability than an asset. I mean, they were never considered an ally in the Western sense of the world. They were considered a sort of a trading partner who could be relied on to cooperate in military matters. But now they've got to discount that. And of course, trading with Russia to get oil and what have you, that's difficult because the pipelines have to be built. In other words, all the pipelines going to Europe and what have you are empty now. I mean, they're not being used. And it takes years to build the new ones. Now, they had already started before 2022 building these new pipelines, but that's a long-term proposition. So the Chinese have a lot more problems than Taiwan does, and they're playing offense. And it's much easier to play defense. Now, as Austin pointed out, they got what lessons they could from Ukraine, and most Taiwanese, for example, support extending the mandatory military service back to a year, and they basically only 6% of the population would consider becoming part of China again. So you have overwhelming support for staying independent, and overwhelming support for fighting to do that. It's a question of who's going to roll the dice and what the outcome is going to be.
Austin, you want to wrap this up for us?
Yeah. The one of the themes in the articles or analytic columns that I read comparing or learning from Ukraine for Taiwan. I'm not going to try to put a figure on it, but let's say a substantial number of them ignored the fact that the Chinese have to launch an amphibious and airborne operation. Several of them also weren't aware that China had tried the missile drizzle tactic. 95, also 96, where they were firing short range and a few medium range ballistic missiles into the sea around Taiwan, sending a message: "We got you bracketed." So, China's experimented with that, and now experimented with it 25, 26 years ago. It's a tactic. You could see that Russia has tried. It's not a drizzle, but a missile bombardment to break Ukraine's will, and they failed. And in the case of Taiwan, as Jim pointed out, unless you're using nukes, you're going to be hitting a lot of rock and probably losing missiles to a more sophisticated, at least initially more sophisticated, air defense system. There are big differences in what Taiwan and Ukraine face. But after that, you get into, again, a nation in arms, and Jim said pointed out the Taiwanese, they don't want to be part of mainland China. And you've got the morale and national will factor. A lot of people very surprised by the Ukrainians' resistance, and I'll include myself as being pleasantly surprised, even though I'd followed enough of it to see that the Ukrainians, at least the Ukrainian people, didn't want to have any part of Vladimir Putin's Putin's Russia. One other thing, though, and Jim talking about the problems that China's economic problems, and you know, also its production problems and its reliance on certain, despite their veneer of high tech, its their reliance on high technology from the from the West or much more open societies. Taiwan has been shifting some of its premier high tech manufacturing off the island. And Jim had mentioned this some time ago about that there would be a microchip manufacturing a factory here in the United States. It was essentially Taiwanese owned. You've seen that done somewhat by South Korea, like Samsung putting a manufacturing plant and research plant in the United States. It's that, okay, we don't lose everything if Kim Jong-un blows up our manufacturing facilities that are in that the greater Seoul area. We can reconstitute it. And that was a strategic decision by Samsung, but also encouraged by the South Korean government. And same calculations going on with Taiwan. They don't lose everything. Everything doesn't go up in smoke. And that is, but those were trends before, in Taiwan, it began to look like China really was gearing up this time, maybe 2009, 2010. And certainly by 2014, you see the belligerence that Xi Jinping has brought to the China's strategic strategic goals, belligerent strategic goals. But that is something, is a lesson learned from Ukraine? No, it's Ukraine's wasn't in the ability, its industrial base producing steel and turbines and the like. They could have been doing that, but that's also how they employed their workers. In the case of South Korea and Taiwan, their elite industries are something that they can, in this case, offshore to the United States, and have the ability to reconstitute their businesses after a war. That's not learning particularly from Ukraine, but it's an important thing to note, and I'm just adding it because of what Jim had to say about China's weaknesses.
Well, we'll wrap it up there, gentlemen. We're out of time, and we'll talk to you guys next time.
Okay, till then.
Take care, guys. Bye.